Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2013. Lecture 4, delivered on August 28, 2013. The title of this lecture is Interest Rates and Risk.
Today, Interest Rates and Risk. This lecture will begin by reviewing just briefly what I had mentioned in the last lecture. As I move these tables out of the way and actually do what's called teaching. Ow, God! Almost hurt something I care about. When I write down an interest rate, I'm talking about a generic rental rate on capital of some kind. And there are different rental rates for different types of money and capital. At the heart of every interest rate, as I had said before, there is this risk-free rate, which has two components to it. You have the real rate of return, and you have an expected inflation premium. They are buried under the surface. And I'm going to talk about those, come back to those here in just a little while when I get to the Federal Reserve. And I'm going to give you an assigned reading for the weekend, a two-part series that I wrote some years back in 2007, 2008. It goes into the details of the Federal Reserve. And I'll also have a video for you to watch, too. But for now, I'm just going to say the risk-free rate is a rock rate underneath everything, representing the pure opportunity cost of foregone consumption. The closest we see to it in the real world is the rate on a short-term treasury bill. So if we use this in practice for one thing or another, you'll see some places where we use this. We usually say, okay, we can't see the actual risk-free rate. It's a theoretical thing, but it is very closely represented by the rate on a short-term treasury instrument. And then we have this beast called the risk premium. It has three parts to it. The risk premium. Now, the first part is called the default premium. That is a compensation for taking the risk in lending money that part or all of what you want are expecting to get back won't come back to you. So a bank, for example, would assess a default premium based upon the probability that you would that there will be a default by a borrower, and also the probability that that default is going to have a materially adverse consequence on the bank or the other lending institution or the financial intermediary or the surplus economic unit. But anyway, now the next one here I need to talk about for a little bit. It's called the maturity premium. The maturity premium. This one is a no-win for the lender, and that's why they charge a maturity premium. Here's the thing. You finally graduated from this fabulous institution, and you have gotten your first job as the assistant manager at a Jiffy Lube on the south side of Memphis. You've decided that you are going to get your first home because you found yourself a significant other. You get a double-wide trailer for the double-wide wife and yourself, and you go about your business of borrowing the money for this. Okay, well, let's not say a trailer. Let's say a nice little home. Okay, a hovel, but it's a home. Okay, you borrow on this house. And the interest rate that you borrow is, has an APR, let's say, of 6%. Okay, now, I'm the lender. And you are borrowing for 30 years, so I'm expecting you to make monthly payments for 30 years. And I'm expecting to get a rate of return on my money of 6%. That's why I charge you that. Now tell me what would happen if interest rates on mortgages, after, let's say you're in the house for 5 years, interest rates on mortgages fall to 3%. What are you going to do?
I would expect to pay lower to you.
I'm not going to give you lower. You can bite me. But some other lender might. What do we call that? Do you know what that's called? Yeah, that's a refi. You're going to refi that mofo real fast at 3%. I want 6% for you for another 25 years. Interest rates fell to 3%. You're going to borrow the money from some other lender at 3% and pay me back my money. That's bad for me because I was expecting 6% from you for 25 more years. Even worse is that when I get that money back, what am I going to lend it out at? You better believe it, prevailing. So that really sucks for me. So I'm going to have to charge you a little more because you could screw me on that deal. Now, here's a little factoid on the side. The typical person who borrows on a mortgage doesn't keep the mortgage alive for 30 years or 25. The average homeowner holds a house for 7 years. That's typical. And then they sell that one and move on to a bigger one because obviously by that time you're going to have 12 kids and you're going to need a larger place. Okay? Now in your case, 20. Yeah. Okay, so you see, I know that this person is going to dump the loan. I really do. In about 7 to 10 years, you'll sell that house. You'll buy a new house. So I'll be paid off and whatever. But what happens if interest rates skyrocket to, let's say, 14% on mortgages? At about year 7, interest rates go through the roof, and they stay up there. How is that going to affect your decision on buying a new home? Going to make you want to buy a new home, or is it going to make you, you're going to stay. You're going to remodel. You're going to say, this place ain't half bad. You're going to do anything you can not to leave that home. So in other words, I would love it if you would pay off your loan in 7 years, because then I could relend the money at 14%. But you, no. At 14%, you're not going to go out there and borrow money, get on a nice, fancy new home. You're going to stay where you are. So my expectation, when interest rates go up, I'd love to have that money back so I could lend it at a higher rate. You're not going to do that to me. So you see, I lose as a lender either way. If interest rates go down, you're going to refi on me. I get my money back and I have to lend it at a lower rate. But if interest rates go through the roof, you're not going to sell that home when I expect you to, and I am stuck with you paying 6% to me, when if I had your money back, I could be lending it out at 14%. So I am drilled either way on this deal. So the longer a loan is, the more likely interest rates are going to go up or down. That's just the longer, the more chance that there's volatility. So I am going to have to charge you a maturity premium. And a maturity premium will be bigger the longer the loan. So on a car loan for 5 years, there won't be much of a maturity premium, because the volatility could set in, but it's not likely that you could do anything about it. But on a 30-year mortgage, I'm going to pack that thing with a lot of maturity premium, because I'm pretty sure something's going to happen that is not in my interest. Interest rates are going to go down, or interest rates are going to go up. The probability that you will get struck by lightning, sir, in the next year is incredibly low. But if someone said, well, what about in the next 70 years? Well, there's more of a chance that something bad will happen to you, and I'll be there to video record it, obviously, for YouTube. But you see, there's the thing. The longer the time frame, the more likely that something is going to happen adverse to my interest. And in this case, interest rates going down or interest rates going up are both adverse to my interest. So the longer the debt instrument is, the more the maturity premium will be. And interestingly enough, that's the only risk premium that would be in a government instrument, like a bond. So now we move on to the next one, the last one. Now, you'll hear me slip and call this the liquidity premium. The textbook calls it the illiquidity premium. Either way, it's essentially, it is a reward for the possibility that I'd have a hard time getting rid of your debt. I'll try to explain this. Madam, you are a wealthy person. You got money to lend friends and sometimes, you know, some homeless person. Well, here's the deal. This fine, upstanding young man, he comes from a great family. He has a lot of connections, and he's obviously of good breeding, good habits. He goes to church on Sunday. He doesn't beat dogs. And so what we're going to say here is that he wants to borrow $1,000 from you. But he's not going to borrow $1,000. He says, I shall pay you back $1,000 in a year on an IOU, on what we call a promissory instrument, a promissory bill in this case. So he says, I'd like you to lend me some money and I will pay you back $1,000 in a year. So in other words, it's like a discount note. Okay, so now what would you say you would lend him? Just give me a number that seems reasonable to you. 900, okay, we'll buy that. Okay, so he prepares all this nice paperwork. He has his dad's lawyers. Wherefore, I am borrowing from you for this amount of money for, and all that. And it's signed, and there's a seal and a notary. Takes care of the guarantee that he did sign and witnesses. It's even got nice real parchment paper. Now, you know me. I was a professor of yours years ago. But times got bad, and eventually I ended up homeless on the streets. And I see you one day walking down the street. Ew. I know you. Well, I'll be damned. God almighty, you are really nice. I'm not very well now. I got tubes in me. Matter of fact, my kidney tube's coming out. Could you stick that back in? It's trickling down my butt. I need to borrow some money. I got a deal coming through. In 1 year, I can give you back $1,000. But you know, I don't have any way. You know, but I got a napkin here. I'll sign. I owe you $1,000 here. Here's your damn napkin. Guaranteed. Okay. What are you gonna lend me? Give me a number. Hurt my feelings. 100. Are you out of your mind? My God, I thought I was the only Jew here. You understand. It's an inside joke. Goya, you don't understand. Anyway, you see, you don't trust me as much. There's more risk. Now, here's the interesting thing about that risk. There's a piece of that risk. Suppose you really needed money back before a year. Now, you've got two instruments. You've got a piece of napkin that I drooled on, and it smells slightly of tobacco and whiskey. And then you got this great piece of parchment paper. And you go to another wealthy person, you know, and you say, I'm kind of short right now, but I do have these two things that I could sell. One gives you back $1,000 in 6 months. The other one gives you back $1,000 in 6 months. Okay, which one of those is someone going to pay more for? So in other words, mine will have a much steeper discount if you try to unload it. You might not even be able to unload it. So you see, you're going to assess me a larger interest rate. In other words, you are going to actually lend me less money simply because it would be pretty hard to unload this thing of mine, this napkin. His, you could probably sell it in a heartbeat. But mine, oh, that's going to be hard to sell. You might not even be able to sell it for more than about $110, $120, even though it's a $1,000 face value on it. So you see, if instruments are difficult to unload, they carry a higher liquidity premium. Instruments that are easy to sell off carry very low, to some extent, no liquidity premium. So what this means in practical purposes is that things that have markets are very easy to sell, and they'll have low liquidity premiums. To give you an example of this, when I was a penny stock, when I owned a penny stock house, it was actually really a pain in the butt to sell stock. Someone would want to sell. I have 100 shares of XAO Corporation. Yeah, well, I know, but I mean, I don't even know who I could sell that to. There's, you know, I'm going to put it up on the bulletin board and hope that one of the market makers knows someone who would buy it. But I can't guarantee you I'm going to get rid of this for months. I'll just put up, you got 1,000 of it to sell? Cripe. That's going to be a big load for someone. And I couldn't make a promise. At the same time, if someone said, I've got some Microsoft to sell, it will sell within milliseconds, instantly. That is that liquidity premium in operation. If it's a well-known instrument and there is a fully fleshed-out market for it, I'll sell it in a heartbeat. No liquidity premium. No risk of that kind. But if it's something weird, I'm not going to be able to find a market for it. So, what does that mean in practical terms? When a bank issues a mortgage loan, I don't know if people really know this or not, but almost never does that bank have that loan for more than a few hours before it sells it to a massive market like Ginny Mae or Fannie Mae. Because what they do is they just sweep up all these mortgages that are originating every day. They bundle them together into these massive packages of goo. And then they sell them to insanely wealthy investors like countries, trust funds, insurance companies, investors of all kinds. Mortgages are so easy to sell, to get rid of, the banks won't even hold them for a day in some cases before it's just gone. In fact, in some cases, the bank doesn't even have the mortgage at all. It simply acts as a flow-through agent for some giant pool that then absorbs that mortgage into a package that is sold off, bundled and sold off. So mortgages are just instantly liquidable, especially if they're like FHA loans, VA loans, your student loans. Until recently, well, it's still the case. But as soon as you got a student loan, it was gone within hours because they would package them up and a corporation called Sallie Mae would bundle them together and then sell them to massive investors, heavy-duty, powerful investors. Your bank that you were making the payments to on a mortgage, on a student loan, they were nothing but just an agent that was collecting a little fee for processing and moving the money on to where it really belonged. So those kinds of markets are instantly liquidable. Credit card debt is about the same way, highly liquid. It can be sold off very quickly to companies that specialize in buying up that kind of debt. So almost any kind of debt that is from a financial institution of some kind is going to have a very low or zero liquidity premium. If it is some oddball instrument, then the liquidity premium is going to be a beast. Now, the subprime lending market, which turned into a toxic waste pit and has now become the evil of all evils. What was really big about subprime mortgages was back in the old days, even back in the after the turn of this century, once a bank lent to a risky lender, to a risky borrower, someone who didn't have great credit and all that, bank couldn't get rid of those loans. It was married to those nasty little things. So it was taking pretty big risk. One of the big things that helped people who didn't have great credit was when markets developed so that those could be swept up into these big pools out of the bank's hands as fast as traditional loans could, traditional mortgages. So in other words, what was the original idea was actually kind of noble. We have many people in this country who can't get a home because their credit is defective or they don't have a big down payment. So we've got to make a market for them. Well, we have a market, but banks can't get rid of these, and banks don't want to hold loans anymore. Well, we developed this market for them, just like a Sally Mae or a Ginnie Mae or a Freddie Mac or something like that. And that was one of the ways that we made it so that these people could get home loans because the banks were no longer the risk bearers, the gatekeepers. The bad side of that was they weren't the risk bearers and the gatekeepers, so they were giving out subprime mortgages like candy because it wasn't their problem. They just gave the loan, made the loan, and then they sold the loan off to the big dogs. And then the big dogs repackaged it, sold it off to others. By the time it was over with, no one could tell where a subprime mortgage really was. What investor has this subprime mortgage? Hell, no one really knew with all the derivative instruments that were written on the things, too. There's a risk premium. And it has, so this is why you pay different interest rates for different things. Now, financial intermediation. One thing in the textbook, I'm going to give you a heads up. They have this section in your textbook about what agencies regulate what financial institutions. I really am not going to hold you to account knowing what agency of what government actually watches over what banks. But suffice it to say that our banking system in the United States does not have a single regulator. There is not one government body that watches all of the banks in the country. That would be great, but it ain't the case. And one of the attempts to reform the banking industry after the financial crisis in 2008 was to say we've got to bring all banks in the United States under a single regulatory authority. That went over like a turd sandwich. And the reason was turf. The FDIC oversees some banks. We're not going to give up our authority over those banks. States watch some banks. We're not going to give up our state-chartered banks to some federal agency. The Federal Reserve oversees some banks. No, we're not going to do that. We're not going to give up ours. We should be the only one who regulates. And so there you have it. Different banks are regulated by different entities. Some are state-regulated because they're state-chartered. Some are regulated at the national level, but they are regulated by the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. Some are regulated by the Central Bank of the United States, the Federal Reserve. Others are regulated by other agencies. And, of course, then you've got the credit unions and all that kind of stuff. Okay. Well, here's the bottom line of all that. I don't want to really stir up trouble here. Now I'll do this on the next lecture. But I mentioned something called the Federal Reserve. I'm going to take you back into the dark past, back long before you were born. I... Oftentimes, and this is true all through history, if enough time passes, something terrible is not terrible anymore, and people forget how terrible it was. I notice, for example, that there are jokes made these days. There are at some of the comedy websites and all that. Jokes are made about Auschwitz. Or jokes are made about the civil rights movement. Or people say, well, it didn't really work that way. Or, you know, it wasn't as bad. Slavery wasn't as bad as we say it was. We've got some academics who are writing papers now saying slavery was actually a pretty decent system. We forget. Well, you see, back in the 1800s, there was no regulation as we see it today of the business environment. And it was a very bad time. For example, regulation of how companies treat their workers didn't exist. And the first labor movement was embracing socialist concepts written by Karl Marx because, you know, the government wasn't going to help. The government was the best government money could buy. It was in the hands of the robber barons. The presidents, the senators, the judges, the representatives were all in the hands of the wealthy. And so it was just free market. That's free market. And the people suffered. And the same was true, for example, in banking. Banking was a wild west. Investment firms were just crazy. They could offer pyramid schemes that were just insane. People were suckered into them, lost all their money. Banks would start out with hardly any capital, and then when people deposited their money, the banks would just go and spend it, things like that. Banks collapsed all the time, and in many cases, a bad bank collapsing caused good banks all around it to collapse. It's called a bank run, and I'll mention that. And you'll see a little bit more about that in the next lecture or two. But it was just madness. And it was so bad that it was having macroeconomic impact. Typically, a libertarian, free market kind of mentality is this. Look, the good will survive, the bad will fail, and the field will be cleared of the evil and the inefficient. That's fine. But the problem is, in reality, the ripple effects can cause so much damage that the good are creamed along with the bad, and the economy itself gets hurt. And that has political consequences. We've seen it several times in American history, where we went so far with ignoring problems that the people finally said, are you kidding me? This has got to stop. We're going to start throwing bastards out of office until we get their attention and you get this back together. As a matter of fact, that was what happened with the Native Americans at Wounded Knee. We finally went so far by slaughtering men, women, and children, killing them, shooting them in the back as they were running away up the knee to the chapel, that when it got in the presses, people said, that is enough of this insanity. Same thing happened with the way that workers were treated in the 1920s and the way poor people were being treated. Finally, people said, enough is enough. So we get to the end of the 1800s. These bank follies had gotten so crazy that the economy itself was beginning to suffer from some of these. One bank would fall apart, a scam operation, and people would freak and they would go to their banks and those banks would fall apart, more banks would fall apart. You could have as many as 25 to 30% of the banks in a single big city die, fall apart overnight. And when you get that many banks failing and that many depositors losing their money, you start to get riots. And they also go to the ballot box and they start kicking the bastards out of office, the greedy, corrupt politicians. And so we finally, at the turn of the 20th century, we saw an era of reforms of various kinds. There was a crackdown on monopolies, which had been allowed. Free markets, monopolies, it's free market. They cracked down on the monopolies. You even saw a period when the government finally cracked down on the way corporations were treating workers. It didn't last long. The big one came in the 1930s, but there was a period. We finally began to get sick of the way banks were behaving. And so we came to a modern concept called the central bank. In other words, a bank that would regulate banks. It would be the center of policy regarding money. And this was an important thing, too. You see, because a government has two ways that it can affect an economy. Through its fiscal policy. Fiscal policy, jobs programs, taxes, wars. They can affect, the economy can be affected by these, at least in the short run. Taxes go down to stimulate an economy. Taxes go up to slow down an economy. The economy is in the doldrums. Let's have another war. A lot of people are out of work. Let's make some big, huge works projects, jobs projects. That's fiscal policy. The other way that the economy can be affected is through monetary policy. We can just print tons of money, and boy, that'll wake up an economy real fast. Or we can claw in money. That'll slow an economy down pretty fast, too. The problem with these tools in monetary policy, and I won't address fiscal policy here today, but the problem with monetary policy is this. Inflation. Know this. There is only one way to create inflation. Only one way. If the growth rate of the money supply exceeds the real growth rate of the economy, we will have inflation. Period. Inflation cannot be created by a rise in the minimum wage. Inflation cannot be created because some robber baron companies charge more for gas. It doesn't happen. Because if a sector of prices goes up and there's no money to monetize that shock, then people will simply buy less of that product. They'll probably buy less of other products, and those other products will respond in kind by going down in price if there's no money to juice the system. So what that means is that the only way that an economy can experience inflation is if the government makes too much money that the economy doesn't need. But it's tempting to do it. It is so tempting to print money because you can goose an economy. Well, the central bank was created in the United States model to take the politics out of money printing. And it stayed that way for a very long time, but unfortunately it fell apart because Congress some years back said, well, the Federal Reserve doesn't need to worry just about inflation. It should also worry about economic growth. You can't do that. Unfortunately, Congress gave the Fed the authority to do it, and now these days the Fed tries to control inflation but also tries to juice the economy, which is a very dangerous combination. But anyway, the Federal Reserve, our version, the United States Federal Reserve, was put in charge of monetary policy to strip the politics out of monetary policy. As some people have noted, it would be wonderful if we had done the same with fiscal policy. But constitutionally, we were on shaky ground even doing it with monetary policy. But here's the deal. When I say money, I'm going to do something here. Here's a term, liquidity. Liquidity. Madam, you're sitting here at the front. See this? What is this?
A dollar bill.
Okay. Now, if I wanted a cheeseburger, would this work? Sure. Liquidity means the ease and efficiency with which an asset can be turned into another asset. The ease and efficiency with which an asset can be turned into another asset. So in other words, this would be a highly, highly liquid instrument. Immediately, I can have a cheeseburger. Well, here's the thing. This has value. You have value too, don't you?
Yeah.
You're worth something. Can I turn you into a cheeseburger? Well, I sure as hell could, but it would take me a while. You know, the grinding and all that kind of stuff. It would be, so in other words, you are an asset. You certainly are, but you are not a liquid asset. You are a highly illiquid asset. A house is an asset, but you can't turn that into a cheeseburger very quickly. You could, you'd have to wait and sell the house, you know, deal with the contracting, all that. It would be take time to do it. It's not a highly liquid asset. In order to get it turned over rapidly, you would have to do a heavy, heavy discount. You could turn a house into a cheeseburger overnight, but you'd have to sell the house for $5 when it was worth $200,000. So in other words, you would lose a lot of value in that turn. Think about other things that have value, and you can put them on a spectrum of liquidity. Cash is highly liquid. Treasury bills are extremely liquid. Not quite as liquid, but they're liquid. You can't take a T-bill to Wendy's and get a double cheeseburger, but you could call any broker and just immediately it would be turned into cash for it. Traveler's checks. Have any of you ever used traveler's checks? You have? They're not as nearly as popular as they used to be, but they are still in that category of the most liquid money. Checking accounts at banks are considered highly liquid because a check can be turned into cash immediately. Interestingly enough, though, do any of you have a credit union account? They have those checks. They're not considered as liquid as bank checks. So we don't put them in the same category as bank checks and money. Because even though almost never would a credit union check not be honored, they don't have to because they're not actually demand deposits. They're called negotiable order of withdrawal accounts, NOW accounts. So in other words, if I have someone writes me a check from a credit union, and I go into that credit union and say I should like my money, they can say no, not for 30 days, or 10 days, or 3 days. If I go into a bank and I say I have a check that's drawn on this, here's proper credentials, they can't say no. It is a bearer on demand instrument. Keep that in mind. Credit unions are fabulous, but they do not have the quality of liquidity, and so we don't count them as in the same category as cash and currency, demand deposits at banks, real banks, and traveler's checks. You mean why are they not like that? It was politics. Credit unions have some powerful advantages over normal banks. Like, for example, credit unions aren't taxed, for God's sake. Credit unions essentially are coddled. They're sort of like something that competes with banks, but has advantages, tax advantages over banks for the creators of them. So in order to balance that out, they they simply created rules that were more restrictive on what credit unions could do with deposits as far as loans and how credit unions could satisfy demands on the deposits from them. That's a good question. It was just sort of like a balancing act. Now, you'll hear banks just scream bloody murder these days. These credit unions are destroying us. We've got to stop this. And I've actually been in speeches where bank officials here in this town bawled crocodile tears about how the credit unions were hurting them so badly. Well, that's sort of the price that banks paid because the credit unions were sort of established because banks could not satisfy the needs of people as well. So here's the deal. We break down the money supply into three, actually there used to be four categories. There is, five, okay. I'm going to show you a couple that aren't in the book that no one talks about anymore. But they're still actually very important. Okay, and I might even bring these up on a quiz or an exam. So write them down because you won't see them in the book. This one is not mentioned hardly ever. It's M0. It's called base, or the base currency. It is as pure as you can get. It is cash and currency. Cash and currency. It is nothing but greenbacks and coins. It's as purely liquid as you can get. Hardly anyone ever mentions it. Most economics textbooks don't even mention it. The reason I'm bringing it up is this. I'm always looking for some kind of data that most people don't look at that has something in it that looks strange or behaves oddly. And so M0, most of the time this M0 grows at a fairly steady rate. It's like a hum. Underneath all of the fancy currencies and securities and all that, this is like just the cash and currency that people and businesses keep in their pockets. And it has this nice hum. Well, interestingly enough, one of the signals that I saw before the financial crisis, and one of the a minor reason I was calling that there was something really bad, really dark going to happen, was M0 began to wobble. It no longer had that slow, steady thing to it. And that's sort of like, that's strange. Why would that happen? I never really came up with a good answer. But since then, I've kept an eye on M0. And every now and then, it has this turbulence in it that you wouldn't have seen ever except in the 21st century. Every now and then, it wobbles. And it actually got me really concerned because about a year and a half ago, it began to wobble like it did right before the financial crisis of 2008. It began to dip. Why would this thing fall? Where's that money going? Why is it vanishing? The Federal Reserve is printing money like there's no tomorrow. Why is M0 going down? I didn't get an answer to it, and I still haven't quite figured it out, but it's just one that I bring up. If you get into this research or analysis of any kind in business, it's something just to keep your eye on because it does tend to give us a warning signal of some kind. I don't understand what it is. But anyway, the first official one is M1. This is cash and currency, demand deposits, and traveler's checks, M1. In other words, pretty much the money that everyday people and businesses use. It's the grease of the economy. It's what we have that's really how our economy goes from day to day. Now remember, if this thing grows too fast, faster than the real growth rate of the economy, you can get some nasty, eventually inflation will happen. But there's another side to that too. If it doesn't grow as fast as the real growth rate of an economy, the economy begins to starve. because everyday people and businesses don't have the lubricant they need in the transmission. And you begin to see things ball up. This was a critical, critical part of why the economy collapsed in 2008. The Federal Reserve had brought the growth rate of M1 down to zero. But the economy's real growth rate was around 3% through that period. So what was happening was that the economy was growing. Businesses were growing. People and businesses were forming. People were had growing in their incomes and all that. It wasn't spectacular, but they were growing. So for several years, there was an economy that was getting worse and worse in its ability to just simply transact everyday business. M1 was brought down to zero. Why in the world would the Fed do something like that? Because ultimately that can cause an economy to buckle. And you can start to get nasty things like deflations, which we want to stay on the other side of the galaxy from. Let's take you to the second, next one. M2. M2 includes M1. Make sure you understand that. But M2 also includes some things that aren't at nearly as liquid, like big CDs and time deposits are in M2. Rich people's money. Institutional money. In other words, money that can't be pulled out to buy a cheeseburger very quickly. And then there's one above this called M3. M3. This includes M2. So in other words, each of these is inclusive of the one under it. But it includes extraordinarily illiquid stuff, including massive time deposits. Now, by massive, I'm talking like $500 million CDs. And it also includes something else. It includes euro dollars. Euro dollars are the money that we send overseas when we buy foreign merchandise. So that means that when you buy a toaster from China, you get a toaster. China gets the money in American dollars. Those American dollars don't go to the Chinese merchants. The Chinese merchant gets the local currency. The central bank keeps the American dollars, and it puts them in its central bank as what is called the Foreign Reserve. That means that M3 includes all of that money that we use to buy oil from the Middle East and Canada and all those places. It includes all that money we use to buy cars from Japan, and it includes all of that money that we use to buy all of that Chinese stuff that was on the shelves at Walmart. Okay, it's highly illiquid because the Chinese, the Japanese, the Canadians, the Arabs, the rest of the world, they can't just take those euro dollars out of their central bank and buy cheeseburgers with them. So within M3, it works like this. Here is the U.S., and let's say here's China. Now, when we buy a toaster from China, China imports to the United States a toaster. We export to China a dollar. That's called the current account. That's called the current account. Nasty. Because you see, the balance of trade will create either a trade surplus or a trade deficit. In this case, we send more dollars to China than China sends yuan. We buy hardly any stuff from China. But we buy, I'm sorry, We sell hardly anything to China. So we collect very few yuan in our central bank. They collect tons of dollars in their central bank. Now, why did this happen? It wasn't because of free markets. It was because the Chinese were artificially pegging their currency at about a third of its actual price. So we were buying Chinese goods at a third of what they would have originally been, a free market would have set them at. China pegged its currency for years. We let them do it. First, we let them do it because we thought that by stimulating private markets in China, the people of China would begin to force the communist government to become more liberalized and Western-like. Later, we did it for the following reason. So now, the Central Bank of China, the People's Bank of China, collects all of these dollars, these American greenbacks, in what is called their foreign reserve. The only place they can spend those dollars is back in the United States. That's how currencies work. You can't spend American dollars in France. You can't do it. It's not the way it works. Those dollars have to come back here. So how does China do that? China exports the dollars back to us. We import our dollars back by borrowing from the Chinese. We paid for these tax cuts that we had in 2001. We paid for two wars, Iraq and Afghanistan. We paid for the things that we did that were more than what we were taking in taxes. We went beyond that. You wanted to borrow for a house? Well, there was money, but a lot of it was coming from China. You wanted to borrow for a car? Well, that was coming probably from China or Canada dollars. Their banks had the American dollars. And so they would import them back here as long-term investment, the capital account. But you're saying, well, wasn't that one up there a two-way flow? What's flowing back to China? In order to borrow that money, in order to have that investment in stock offerings, in bond offerings, in student loans, in home mortgages, what we gave up was future claims on cash flow. So we exported future money that we earned here. So in other words, because we borrowed from China, Canada, the Arab states, all of that, we have to pay them back. So they basically have a claim on money that we will make for the next 100 years or 50 years or whatever. And so that is the flow. See that money right there? That's an M3. That's euro dollars. That's euro dollars. Now, next week, I'll show you a chart. But essentially, what it looks like is over the 21st century, we saw in this period right now, M1 was just bobbling around at approximately zero. M2 was growing. But remember, M2 has M1 in it. So whatever was in M2 that wasn't in M1 must have been growing pretty darn fast. But then the scary one. By the time we get to about the end of 2007, early 2008, M2 was growing at a annual rate of about 5%. M1 was growing at an annual rate of about 0%. But then the scary one. M3, by the early 2008, M3 had reached a growth rate of just under 20%. It was growing out of control. So what did the Federal Reserve do? In 2006, in March, it stopped publishing M3. That's how it's dealt with it. It just stopped publishing it. Said, no, you don't need it. They actually said no one uses M3. What they were doing was trying to cover up a terrible situation that M3, which contained these two things, which would be slowing it down, it was growing at an insane rate because of the amount of American dollars we're accumulating in the central banks of our trading partners. The speculation is that the Fed was choking off M1 because that was basically the only thing that they had that was in M3 that they could control. They couldn't control our trade. They couldn't control long time deposits. So the only piece of M3 that they could slow down was M1, because they print the M1. And so we come to that. There you are. They stopped publishing M3 in 2006. Several organizations that I work with continue to do the calculations, and that's the only reason we know what it was doing. And it was clear that something severe was happening, something very dangerous was happening. But here we're going to go back to the beginnings, to money. And I'm going to have to ask you, sir, what is money?
Currency I can use to...
Currency?
No. Things
I don't know. Say, you said a right good word.
Things that I can give to someone else.
For
other things that I want.
There you go. What's the requirement for something to be money? Can you tell me there's only one thing required? Say that again. Culture? No. You are a moose.
What?
You're a moose. Are you old enough to remember Rocky and Bullwinkle?
Yeah.
You know, hey, Rocky, why don't we pull a rabbit out of my hat? Nothing up my sleeve. Presto! See, see, I got a moose. Okay, now, you, what do you have that I want? Oh, your daughter's ugly. You make pie. Okay, you've got an apple pie. I've got a moose. Now, you need some meat. Yeah, my God, you do. I mean, you're muscle. And do you lift, even? Okay. Protein. You got a pie, right? Okay, I'll give you this moose for your pie. Agreed?
Sure.
Okay. Currency. Moose. There was, culturally, people would look at this deal and say, ew, moose. You see, but it was a currency. Why? Because you and I agreed that it was. That's the only thing that's needed for a currency to, for something to be a currency, is mutual agreement of the transacting parties. That's all that's needed, ever. Okay, you follow it? You see, now some currencies are more widely accepted. This woman refused my moose. She said, no, I don't want moose. I mean, moose is stink, you know, gross. Bring me bacon. So, we start with that. Now, the oldest kind of currency is moose currency, pie currency. We call that nothing but barter money, barter money. Barter money is, there's a very special characteristic of barter money. I'm going to tell you a secret. I can eat moose. I can eat pie. Do you agree with me?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. You ever had moose?
No.
Okay, you ought to try it sometime.
Where do you get moose?
My dad used to go up to Canada and shoot moose and bring them back down, and then mother would bitch because when she cooked it up, it would stink up the house, and we'd have to live outside for, literally for the rest of the day because of the smell. But anyway, okay. But here's the deal. Okay, you see, I can use these. Pure, the entire thing, I can consume it. The pie, the crust, the sauce, the pie, the apples in it, I can eat the whole thing. Moose, well, you know, the bones are going to be a little bit chewy, but I can do that. Break them up, make a moose soup. Okay? Every bit of that currency can be used. That's the characteristic of barter monies. The power of them is that you can either use them for trade or you can eat them. Now, the next kind of money that comes along is metal money. Metal money. Sometimes we call that commodity money. I worry about that because commodity is really more like barter, a term of barter. But commodity money is, I call it metal money. Metal money is simply money that is made of metal. Now, metal can be traded or it can be used. The thing, though, about metal monies is that they cannot be used as well as barter money can. Have you ever heard, madam, do you like gold? Have you ever seen gold? Actual gold, the bars? I've seen the big ones. I've seen Krugerrands. They are so beautiful. Cultures throughout history have just loved gold. But you know what? There's an interesting thing about gold. I can't eat it. I can make jewelry out of it. You can make jewelry out of it and someday possibly even get laid by trading it in Bangkok. But you see, that means that it does have some convertibility into an edible, usable thing. But it is not as complete. You see, we find in history sometimes coins. We don't find coins, but we find arrowheads. If we look carefully, we see minting marks on them. At sometimes in history, people took coins and banged them out because it was a lot more useful to shoot someone dead than it was to buy something at ye olde beer shop. So we can use them, but metals are limited in their usability. They still have consumability features, but they're not as consumable as barters. So in other words, there is an interesting thing. Barter monies have a certain lack of liquidity. If you don't like moose, I can't do anything with a transaction. But they also perversely, almost paradoxically, have a greater, liquidity in a way. So now we get to the final kind of money, fiat money. Fiat money. Fiat money, actually, it's actually pronounced fiat, but no one says it that way. Sir, I want you to do me a favor. I want you to read this fine print right here, right there.
Okay, this note is a legal tender for all debts, public and private.
This note is legal tender. In other words, the only reason this is money is because the government says if you don't accept it as money, the government will kick your ass. Fiat money is money that is only valuable by decree of a sovereign. This thing has no intrinsic value whatsoever. You cannot eat it. You ever try to eat these? Roughage? Yes. Yes, you could use it for toilet paper. But there again, the dye stain. It's hard to get out. And that's really not romantic. Okay? Yeah, you could light it in a cigar with it and all of that. But I mean, even there, what are you going to do after you've lit your cigar? You're going, oh, God, it's on ash. See, it doesn't really have any use other than as a currency. It is pure in that way. Fiat monies, you hear people bitch all, well, we got to go back to a gold standard because our dollar. Okay, great. What's the gold standard going to do for you that the fiat money doesn't? Well, it's gold. Well, what's gold good for? Okay, it's gold. Can you eat it? No. Can you sleep with it? No. What good is it? Well, it's gold. Oh, horse crap. Even gold is acceptable as a currency only because everyone agrees that it is. There are cultures where you'd bring them gold and they'd still, the cannibals, they'd still cook you. Okay? You bring them a cow, they'll cook the cow instead of you. So any of this crap about, well, we got to go back to real gold in our, well, why do you worry about it? Because gold is valuable only because people agree that it is. Just like these are valuable only because of that. Go ahead. The metal money is intermediate liquidity to the extent that, okay, here's the zombie apocalypse. Now, you've remembered your cardio, your double tap, okay? And you've got it down, don't go into a public restroom, you know, the whole nine yards from zombie land. You watched the movie twice. Okay, but the problem is that if you wanted to buy something, you have a gold coin. You got a gold coin. You run into the store and you say, do you have any Twinkies? Well, no, they stopped making Twinkies last year. Yeah, man, but they started making them again. Well, they never got here before the zombie apocalypse. You got Twinkies. I see them on that shelf. Ah, you got to give me something for that. I got a gold coin. Is that really going to get you those Twinkies? Not unless he can turn that gold coin into bullets to shoot zombies with. So it's kind of intermediate because, yeah, he could beat it into a bullet to knock out a zombie. But at the same time, you know what? If I were him, I'd keep the Twinkies instead. Really, okay? Real economics for real people. That's what we're all about in here. Okay. But it's a good question because really, honest to God, if you are hungry, if you're hungry and you want to go to Mickey D's and get, you know, a couple of Big Macs and fries, which is going to work for you, a $10 bill or a gold Krugerrand? Which one is more likely to be accepted at the checkout window? Seriously, think about it. Yeah, this sorry-ass stuff. I mean, some of the people who work there, they wouldn't even know what that Krugerrand was. That's foreign. We can't accept foreign currency. Oh, dude, it's gold. I don't care. Okay, see, there we go. So it's a complex thing. Now, here we go. The fiat money is created by the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve has three duties, actually. Our Federal Reserve regulates and supervises banks. That was what was the big thing when the Federal Reserve Act of 1917 was passed, to regulate and supervise banks. In other words, to get this insanity under control that was our bank Wild West libertarian free market, gee, isn't it great that we're all free in this country thing? Free to be screwed by the people who have more power than us. So the Federal Reserve came to bear and was supposed to. It really didn't for quite a while. But finally, the Federal Reserve essentially was forced to. Now, in this capacity, this is where I would bring up the fact that when the Federal Reserve System was created, the United States was divided into 12 districts. Now, at the time, there was much denser population on the East Coast than the West Coast, so the East Coast districts are smaller because they're denser. But the districts going west were bigger because there weren't as many banks in any given area. That's a little bit problematic these days. But there were 12 districts. Now, the bank, the Federal Reserve, is overseen, it is controlled by the Board of Governors. There are seven of these, and one of those seven is the chairman, sort of like the inspirational leader, the big dog, the one who goes and answers questions before Congress, before the Senate, the House. Now, these seven governors are appointed by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate. So in other words, if one is finishing his term or her term, that person is would be reappointed, or someone to replace that person would be appointed by the president. But that person would face confirmation hearings in the Senate. The quality of the governors of the Board of Reserve used to be impeccable. In recent years, though, that has not been the case. This is not just let's bash Bush. It's also Barack Obama, too. To give you an example, in the Bush administration, there one governor's position, chair, one position was open. He appointed a woman who had run a small community bank, and she had run it so badly that when it was taken over by Wachovia, they gave her a pile of money and told her they didn't want her to do anything for the bank anymore. Her main job in her life had been as a dinner theater actress, and she is now a governor. Now, in Barack Obama's era, we have this new talk of a new chairman of the Federal Reserve, as Uncle Ben is stepping down, and the talk is between Larry Summers and one of the governors who is there now, a woman named Yellen. And these two, between them, if I had a choice of which one to shoot first, I'd hold them together so I could make one bullet work for both of them. The quality has gone down that seriously. However, under the board, each of the 12 districts has a district bank that oversees the banks in that district. These district banks each have a bank president. Now, as a rule, and there are exceptions, but as a rule, these bank presidents are the cream of the crop, not just of finance and economics, but also socially. I've met some of them. These are those kind of people like you meet when I've met entertainers that are well known. Some of them just have this aura about them. This is a very important person. This is a person dresses perfectly, eats at the table. I don't think these people even have sex. They're like that. These are impeccable. There are some that have been highly controversial. But taken together, these people, the Board of Governors regulates the banks. In other words, they write the rules. And the district banks supervise. They enforce the rules at the level of their district. Again, the board regulates, the district banks supervise. The second role of the Federal Reserve is to serve as a bank for banks. Banks need a place to deposit their money. The Federal Reserve does that. But there are private commercial banks that do it too. The Federal Reserve stands as a competitor in a highly efficient, thriving market. In other words, there is a public option for banks. They can either do their banking with the Fed, or they can do it through a private bank. And finally, the Federal Reserve conducts monetary policy. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to post in the resources and materials in ReggieNet a link to a Federal Reserve cartoon video that's just great and explains all of this. That's your main job this weekend. That's all I have for you. I thank you.